And not like your second banana, Kelly Leonard is in our studio. He is the Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at Second City. He's the host of Getting to Yes And, a podcast. You can find his stuff at secondcity.com. Kelly is one of the best storytellers we know. And he joins us now and again to sort of tell us some of the stories uncovered in his podcast series. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, John?
What are you doing tonight, by the way?
I am hosting a free, I'm moderating a panel discussion at Second City in our Up Comedy Theater, and it's about the intersection of comedy and social justice.
I don't think of those two things at the same time, usually.
A lot of people don't, except increasingly. And look, if you look at the late night shows and what Stephen Colbert does and what Seth Meyers does, they talk about...
I guess that's social justice. I would see that as talking about politics.
Sure. But I think there's the reason they're talking about politics is because they care about those issues deeply. I'm going to be talking to Katie Borum, who is an academic at Washington University, Crystal Echo Hawk, who runs a group called Illuminative. And we have a Muslim stand-up who is going to actually perform for us and then join the panel.
I've heard about some people who, perhaps this last person you just described, are comics trying to connect. Say it's the Arabs and the Jews, or it's the Russians and the Ukrainians, or the Catholics and the Protestants in different parts of the world, and that can be a bridge.
Yeah.
It also strikes me as dangerous.
Yeah, it can be. And her name is Yasmin El Hadi, and she actually works in Washington in immigration, helping get people in the country. So she is both a stand-up comic and a lawyer, which, if you think about it, maybe is a connection that makes sense. Yeah.
In honor of AAPI, which is the Asian American and Pacific Islander Month, you have done a podcast that sort of reflects on that. I don't even know what I just said. What's your latest podcast?
So this is next week. It goes up, and it's with Ha Jun Chang, who is a professor of economics at SOAS University in London. And he's got a new book called Edible Economics, A Hungry Economist Explains the World.
I have read a review of this, and they say it's terrific.
Yeah, I loved it. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm interested in economics, I think, in the same way most people who are bad at math are interested in economics, which is if you can wrap it in a good story. And that's what this is. So every chapter is about a food item, its history and usage, and Ha Jun uses that food item to explain a specific economic concept. And I picked my favorite. Do you want to hear about that?
Okay.
Okay. My favorite is about chili peppers. And there's a quote at the top of the chapter that says, quote, "The hotness of chili is not really a taste, but a pain." That's something I can relate to. And so Ha Jun landed in England to study at Oxford in the 1980s. And the British Isles in that period were not known for their food. John, I don't know if you remember traveling there.
I was to the British Isles.
In the 80s, maybe?
Well, the last time I was there, I was shocked that the food was actually pretty good where I was, because I thought it was going to be terrible.
No, it was bland upon bland. I was there a lot in that period. So coming from Korea, Ha Jun was used to very spicy food, which is really hard to come by in those days. So he tells a story of taking his friend Duncan Green to a Szechuan restaurant in London. And I think for many people who have eaten at those kinds of restaurants, you'll recall that the menus often have pictures of small chili peppers, right?
Yep.
Next to the dishes, so you can discern how hot that dish is likely to be.
Right.
Zero chilies would be very mild, and five chilies would be super hot. Ha Jun wanted to go for five chilies, but his friend Duncan was not as adventurous. So they ordered most of the dishes with zero chilies. When the food arrived, Duncan kind of blanched. His no chili dish clearly had five or six pinky-sized fried dried chilies in it. And he asked the waitress if this was a mistake. And the waitress explained that a dish having no chili signs next to it didn't mean that there was no chilies in it. The chili sign was just an indicator of the relative hotness of the dish, not an indication of the amount of chilies in it. All Szechuan food has chilies in it.
So did he like the food or...
Not the point of the story. At this point, we figure out what this chapter is about, because the chapter uses chilies to talk about a specific economic principle related to this country.
And that's what this book is all about. Yeah. Edible Economics, A Hungry Economist explains the world. I like it when the world is explained to me through these individual filters,
yeah.
right? So if you study tuna fishing, you learn a little bit about a lot of the history of the world. If you study it told a certain way, I've got a shelf of books in my house, the color mauve, spices, all kinds of things.
Yeah.
And you say, just study this. And in the process of telling you about this, I'll tell you about a lot, which it sounds like where we are now.
Yep.
Because you're looking at me like, hey, you dummy, you don't see the point of this story yet. And I don't know that I do. Podcaster and friend from Second City, that's Kelly Leonard. He, in his next podcast, talks to Ha-Jun Cheng, who wrote a book, Edible Economics, A Hungry Economist Explains the World. It's a bunch of stories that explain the economy, but told through various foods. So is each chapter a different food, per se?
So they talk about spices, they talk about limes, they talk about bananas, and each of those represent some sort of economic principle, whether it's sort of free market or the Royal Navy in the UK. And yeah, it's really interesting.
Okay, so was it the author that was at this restaurant where they had the chili icons?
Yeah. So he and his friend, who didn't want the spicy food, chose the non-chili, zero chili item. And so what this chapter is about...
But they bring out a food with chilies in it still.
Well, yeah, because it doesn't mean that there's no chili. It just means that it's not as hot as the other dishes. So it essentially is not counted. So this chapter is about home and community caregiving. And the idea here is when something is ubiquitous, it's taken for granted. And when something is taken for granted, it doesn't get counted like chili in the chili scale of that Szechuan restaurant. So in the United States... Unpaid caregiving done at home or in local communities. So we're talking about what? Child rearing, educational help to children, childbearing, care for the elderly, disabled, cooking, cleaning, laundry, household management, all that stuff. None of those activities are counted as part of the gross domestic product or the GDP of the country, which is the way we measure economic output in this country.
Are you kidding me?
Nope.
Do other services count? Do accountants and things like that?
Yeah. So Ha-Jun notes that if valued at market rate, if you actually counted caregiving, it would represent 30 to 40% of the GDP.
Is it because a lot of people who are doing caregiving, in fact, don't get paid for their caregiving?
Sure. And also that it's a lot of women doing it. He says, quote, the invisibility of household work is such that we talk of working mothers as if mothers who stay at home don't work.
So what about that?
So this hit me in a very particular way, and I don't think I've told this particular story on the podcast, but remember when Second City caught on fire? Yeah. So I lost my office.
That story.
So Second City caught on fire. The restaurant below us had a grease fire in the kitchen, and the guy who was in the kitchen couldn't handle it and ran away. And it shot straight up. And luckily the theater was saved, but our offices were destroyed, in particular destroyed almost everything I had in my office. And so I got moved eventually here or to Tribune Tower when WGM was over there. And we're in these new offices, and I got a call from my friend Adam Grant, who wrote the book Give and Take. He's a Wharton professor, and he had a friend moving to Chicago. Her name was Ai-Jen Poo, and he asked if I would meet with her. So Ai-Jen was then the executive director of a group called Caring Across Generations, also the head of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. She ended up forming a group called Supermajority with Cecile Richards and Elisa Garza. And I met with her for lunch, and I really didn't prepare, which wasn't smart on my part. So I didn't know that she had, you know, that she had all this stuff. But I talked to her about the work we were doing at Second City and with the University of Chicago around improvisation and behavioral science, and how do we use these two things? How we use the practices and the games and the exercises of improvisation to illustrate the science of how we're bad at listening, bad at decision making, all the stuff that we do at our place.
So many great business applications.
So many. And immediately Ai-Jen said, well, you could actually use all of those for the caregiving community. These are people who are highly burdened. They're not supported. Their stories aren't being told. And like almost immediately we're like, yes, let's do this. So my wife, Ann Libra, and I, working with Ai-Jen and the group at Caring Across Generations, went to the Aspen Ideas Festival, and we sort of presented these ideas to a community. We led a workshop, and our friend Ruth Allman from the Cleveland Clinic, now friend, was there, took the workshop and said, I want to get you a grant to create a program. And we created a 6-week program called Improvisation for Caregivers, which is still going on at the Cleveland Clinic, Las Vegas. And what we did over these 6 weeks is we use improv exercises to help caregivers recognize they're not alone, how to share their burden, how to become more resilient as individuals. And the results have been terrific. We're doing studies of this, and overwhelmingly people who take the class feel that they have more agency, that they're not as burdened. And so this has become something that was really important to us, especially when our daughter got sick and was in the hospital. One of the things Anne and I recognized is, oh, we actually know about what it is to be a caregiver. We know how hard it is, and we have improv practices that would allow us to maybe make this experience better.
Can you give me an example of an exercise?
Yeah. So one of the things that we created was an exercise called Universal Unique. So this is based on the science of Nick Epley at the University of Chicago, who has studied folks and says that, you know, human beings are rather unwilling to share specific details of themselves because they think other people don't care. But in fact, they do. And when you do share specific details, people are inclined to want to know more, want to work with you. They get to know you. So Anne actually created this exercise called Universal Unique, where we pair two people and we have one person pick a banal, you know, subject matter like grocery shopping. And they say to the person in like a minute or so how human beings grocery shop, the sort of universal you. That's not very interesting. And then we say, okay, take a moment, think about how you personally grocery shop. Now do that for a minute. Game completely changes because we're all freaks, right? So we either forget our bags, we have a very specific way that we go inside the grocery, you know, aisles, and we do all our stuff. And people, when we lead this exercise, they're laughing. And they all say this at the end is like, I actually learned a lot about that human being just hearing how they personally grocery shop. So when we were in the hospital with Nora and a new nurse or a new doctor would come in, immediately I'd say, my name's Kelly, this is Ann. We both worked at Second City for 30 years. This is Nora, she also goes by Eleanor, and we have a 100-pound Bernese Mountain Dog named Benchley, who's a jerk. Who are you? And then they'd tell us.
About their pet or something personal
Anything.
About themselves.
They'd know us.
I almost wonder, though, so for the care of my parents, if when a new staff member comes in and is going to work with them somewhat frequently, if they should pick a topic and share grocery shopping or pet
Anything.
History.
Yeah, totally. And one of the things that happened at the hospital with us is because we talked a lot about our dog, invariably the nurses and doctors would then show Nora a picture of their dog or their cat. And it just became this, they're not seeing Cancer Girl. They're seeing Nora, whose parents worked at Second City. They are building a story. And then what we discovered too is often if we had a problem at home and it was like, do we come in? Do we not come in? The doctors and nurses knew us and they'd say, like, we know these parents. We know that they're not like hysterical. Let's have them come in. Or the other, like, no, you're fine. Everything I'm hearing, I know you guys, you're fine. And that's hard because these people are seeing thousands and thousands of people. These caregivers who are paid are incredibly burdened. But we have all these other caregivers who are not paid. And how are we helping them? And the sad part in this country is they're not counted.
So to those people, be they paid or family members who aren't, and by the way, the people getting paid aren't getting paid a lot.
They aren't getting paid a lot.
You think that it would enrich their experience if we or they engaged in this little exercise?
It's very hard not to count someone you see. So this is an exercise that allows you to be seen.
And you mean count figuratively and literally.
I do. I mean both.
We should count them in the gross domestic product, but you should also recognize them as a fellow human being who has needs and concerns.
That's right. We were just talking about this before we came on the air. I'm interviewing a woman who's wrote a book about the power of saying no, because I feel if you have the Yes And podcast, it makes sense to have someone.
Your podcast is called Getting to Yes And.
Yeah.
You're going to interview somebody who wrote The Power of No.
Yeah, and she says in the book that you're 34% more likely to get a yes if you're face-to-face.
I believe that.
I believe that, too.
Well, I'm about 100%. I mean, I'm such a sucker. I don't know what I am, but it's hard. Put it, coward, I think, is the word. It's hard for me to say no face to face. It's easier over the phone.
I'd call you a human being, but you could use coward because it's funnier. But yeah, we you know, the social norm is saying no is a bad thing. We're taught a lot of times. And look, I have to defend the Yes And podcast all the time. Of like, it's not like an unequivocal yes to everything. If you tell me to jump off of a bridge, that's going to be a hard no. And the same goes with this book too, which is, she's not saying don't say yes. She's just saying we got to be aware of our boundaries. We got to be aware of the fact that human beings are prone to actually say yes to things they don't want to say yes to. So here are some ways. And it's very tied in with some of this caregiving stuff, because it's about knowing who you are and expressing who you are to another person, which means taking account of your values and your purpose and your ethics, things that we maybe consider a bit soft, and they aren't at all.
So, Kelly, my folks stay at a place. They have an apartment in a senior complex, and they need a lot of assistance there. Walked in the other day, and a nice lady named Bree was helping my mom or dad do something. And I always say hello and thank you. But they are service engines to me when I walk in, because they're usually walking out. And I don't want to take too much of their time. They've got other apartments to tend to. But so it would strike me as odd for me to spring upon them, hey, I have a wiener dog. What kind of dog do you have, or how do you grocery shop?
Yeah, it strikes you as odd. It's not, though. This is our bias of thinking people don't care, because we actually do. We're curious about other human beings. Think about you. Like, what do you do here? You talk to other people. Your entire job is having other people talk to you about what's on their mind. And people, you know, like, people pay you to do that. Same with me.
Do you think that working from home has made all of this more difficult?
I do. I think the, you know, connection, relationships, we've talked about that before, how important they are to human beings' happiness and their success. And when you are separated by people, even if you've got a screen, that is something between you and another human being. Not to say you can't do these same things on screens, because you can.
But not as well. Ideally, we would be in each other's space a little more.
I think so. I think that's, you know, and look, we're all discovering that, you know, Second City is selling out again. I'm going to a lot of music. Those clubs are sold out. And it's great. I missed it.
Kelly Leonard hosts a podcast called Getting to Yes And. What else should I say about you before I let you go today?
What else should you say?
When does this new podcast you just described?
This is next Tuesday. It comes out next Tuesday.
And the book is titled Edible Economics, A Hungry Economist Explains the World.
Yeah, and thank you for my I have a fancy new title, which you used at the beginning of this.
Let me read it here. Oh, yeah. Vice President, Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development. Dude.
I know. They shouldn't let me make up my own titles, because they're always going to be long.
Well done. Nice to see you, Kelly.
Good to see you.